Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Sochi Winter Olympics underway and examine international political support for Putin on display, with most Western leaders not in attendance except for Holland and Italy. Nina Khrushcheva, a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School, joins us to provide an analysis of how Russia's big showcase event is playing at home and abroad, with national pride on display while international censure continues, inflamed by the lighting of the Olympic torch by a racist member of Russia's parliament who tweeted a doctored picture of President Obama likening him to a monkey being offered a banana. Then we'll examine further the international politics at play in and around Russia's Winter Olympics, as Asian leaders of China and Japan hope that their visits bolster relations with Moscow and may help resolve the long-standing territorial dispute Japan has with Russia over some islands that have prevented the two countries from signing a peace treaty officially ending World War II. Daniel Treisman, a professor of political science at the University of California, Los Angeles, and a leading specialist on the politics and economics of post-communist Russia, joins us to discuss Russia's move towards the East and its relations with the West as its relations with the West sour. Then finally, we will look into The End of Snow, the title of an article in Sunday's New York Times, and speak with Elizabeth Burakowski, a postdoctoral researcher with the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, and co-author of a report commissioned by the Natural Resources Defense Council, Climate Impacts on the Winter Tourism Economy in the United States. We'll discuss how climate change has impacted 10 of the last 19 cities that have hosted the Winter Olympics, previous venues that are now running out of snow, and by mid-century will not be cold enough to host the Winter Games again. And joining us now is Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Khrushcheva.
Thank you, Ian.
And the opening ceremonies, of course, one of the flag bearers in Sochi is, to put it bluntly, President Putin's girlfriend, right? Alina Kabaeva?
Alleged girlfriend, because that has not been public, so to speak. So alleged, let's just stick with that. But yes, one of those, and her choice is very strange, to put it mildly, because everybody else in that ceremony were very quite distinguished athletes and the numerous gold medal winners, and she had just one gold medal in 2004, I think. So she really doesn't measure up to other participants. So that alleged girlfriend clearly got a position there because of her relationship, alleged relationship with Vladimir Putin.
And when Putin was asked about it, he apparently said that this is a red herring. But
yes, he did.
But the what's inescapable, though, is that the Russian athlete who one of the two that lit the Olympic torch, Irina Rodnina, who's a member of the upper house of the Duma, the Russian parliament, she tweeted this racist picture of President Obama as though he likening to a monkey being offered a banana. That, I think, is inescapable. And what's your sense of that?
Well, she's a, you know, she may be a racist personally, and I don't know that at all about her. I mean, she's a rather old athlete. She's a very Soviet athlete. She did indeed win many gold medals. She could be a racist, and she just put it on display. I don't think that this is such a sort of unified political message, but it's her own message, and does show that how closely personal views are related to political views in Russia, because even if you know, that is not the official stance of the United Party, which is the Putin Party. I mean, his own disdain for Barack Obama, either for racist matters or other matters, is always on display every time he does talk about Barack Obama or Barack Obama's America. So it does have probably not a direct connection, but certainly some tangible connection to the state of the U.S.-Russian relations in present times.
Well, when she was asked about this racist tweet of hers with this picture of Obama, who's clearly eating something, and this banana is in the foreground being offered to him as though he's a monkey, she said, freedom of speech is freedom of speech. You're responsible for your own insecurities. Do you know what she was referring to there?
Well, I mean, that's another thing that Russians do very often, is that they turn the message inside out, upside down. So she clearly feels that, it seems to me, I don't know what she exactly means. I mean, we should ask her, mm-hmm. but she feels that civility is not an issue here, but what is an issue here, if America talks about freedom of speech at all times, so she too, or Russia too, has the right to speak freely. So that may be what she was referring to, but quite frankly, it's despicable, it's ridiculous, and, you know, as I said, shows kind of the way the U.S. or Russia view each other, but I don't think we should really continue commenting on that any further, because I don't think there is an answer to it. It is very upsetting that the one who was chosen to bear the torch, such a great symbol of unity, actually created a discord by sending out social media message like that.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I think there was recently one member of parliament, member of the Duma, in response to a growing criticism about the anti-gay laws in Russia, said that the West should in effect tolerate our intolerance. It was a pretty amazing piece of mental gymnastic.
Well, exactly. No, that's exactly, and Russians are good at that, because, you know, basically we've survived for centuries with the doublespeak and kind of figuring out how to say sharp things between the lines and whatnot. So that's very clever. I mean, people do put things. This is nobody in Russia takes anything at face value, and often face value messages taken apart by the Russians and turn it back to the messenger. So, I mean, often things like that come out from Russia. I mean, just take Vladimir Putin's op-ed piece in the New York Times this fall. It was one of those examples. He takes the U.S. message and turns it back to the United States and sort of discusses the messianic nature of the United States and how in contemporary world and modern world, this is not the message that can really function. And, you know, who would be Putin to know what it is in the modern world? Not like Russia is a symbol of modernity.
Well, I think that's the whole idea, though, of this show, isn't it? To show Russia as a business-friendly modern state. And how do you think that played, particularly in terms of the opening ceremony?
Doesn't. I mean, that's so remarkable, is that Putin presents it this way and sees it that way and talks about the national pride, but there's so many, I mean, I keep thinking that, you know, every time that a new story on Justin Bieber, the singer, the teenage singer, comes out, it's like, it's exactly like Russia. It's, you know, we want to think about great performances and all these exploits, and instead we just get bad news. I mean, if we talk about trade relations, I mean, the Chobani yogurt scandal was one of those. So Russia really doesn't, I mean, it is a show. It is a Potemkin village, as often Russia does, but it really doesn't present Russia in a friendly manner, in a modern manner, in a civilized manner. And everybody knows that all propaganda states, that Russia is a propaganda state, often are capable of put up a very good front, a very good show, which Russia did in the opening ceremony. But I don't think that it tricks anybody to see that there's much more behind it, especially with the $51 dollars spent on constructing this quite ridiculous enterprise in the summer resort, the Winter Olympics.
Again, I'm speaking with Nina Kusheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. And you mentioned the Potemkin Village. Of course, in 1787, Catherine the Great went to the Ukraine and Crimea too, and inspect new acquisitions with her trusted military leader, Grigory Potemkin, who went ahead of her and ordered the construction of these fake villages to impress the empress. And that, of course, is the origin of that term. But when you have people like the former Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov saying that between 20 billion and 30 billion of the 50 plus billion to build the Sochi Olympics was spent on embezzlement and kickbacks, is that story resonating in Russia?
To a degree. I mean, we don't know. Nemtsov doesn't know how much was kickback, but generally the rule of the thumb is that whatever Russians spend on construction, half of it was stolen. So that probably 25 would be the right number. Yes, it does. But you know, the thing about Russia and the Russians is that Russians really don't expect much from the government. I mean, so the fact that half of it was stolen is no surprise. Everybody knew that would happen. So when it does happen, nobody's saying, oh my God, how is that possible? It was just never even, I mean, it would be surprising if it didn't happen. That would be a surprise. If it, say, you know, if Russia would spend only $20 billion, that would be sort of a shocker, and stole only 10. But that's the thing. I mean, once again, we come back to that Potemkin village, and I'm really impressed with your knowledge of Russian history, they put up the show, but really there is so not much more behind it, unfortunately, that it's all about turning it right now for that particular moment, and then it's going to rot, collapse, and being wasted, as a lot of great endeavors in the Russian past also have been.
So tell me, Nina, what was your sense, though, of during the opening ceremonies, where there was this sort of pageantry on display of culture and history, but it did feel like the communist era, the 77-plus decades, was somewhat antiseptically brushed over. No mention, of course, of the Stalinist Persians, which, of course, your grandfather was the first person to point out what had really been going on, and to break that that mold of silence, if you will.
Well, I mean, it was a celebration, so I imagine that they wouldn't talk about the purges. I'm even going to give them that. That's okay. But what is really interesting, how really sanitized the Soviet story was, that it, even the Soviet part was a heroic part. And since when you introduced me, you mentioned my book on Vladimir Nabokov, the dissident, the immigrant, the exiled Russian writer, one of the great American writers he has become. And so he was claimed as the great part of Russian history. I was like, wait a minute, he left Russia when he was 16. He didn't write anything when he was in Russia, incidentally, except for a few poems. So that's what kind of remarkable, how it kind of this sort of Russian porridge that they put together of all the great achievements, and all these achievements were aggrandized, and all the problems were swept under the rug, and you create this incredible postmodern formula of the contemporary Putin Russia today, which is also in itself a lie. But another thing that I'm actually surprised people didn't talk about during the opening, is that how London-oriented that is, because as you may remember, the London Olympic Summer Olympics a couple of years ago were also very sort of the sweeping view of British history, although incidentally with some criticism of British history, and yet that sweeping British history with all the great highlights. And so the Russians did exactly what the Brits did, but with a Russian flair, saying, well, how great we are. And that's another interesting thing for me, is that, that whatever Russians do or don't do, it's always about the West. It's either anti-West or imitating the West, and so it goes.
Well, the show is officially called Dreams About Russia, and, of course, it was put together by Konstantin Ernst, who's the director of Channel 1, which is, of course, he's the number one propagandist for and loyalist of Vladimir Putin, since that's Russia's largest state-controlled television channel and is essentially nothing but pro-Putin propaganda.
He's a very talented man, though. He doesn't take away the talent.
Yeah.
He's actually a very talented man.
So in the extent to which the local audience, I take it, really, are they having a good time? I mean, nobody should try and rain on anybody's parade, don't you think, Nina?
Well, nobody should try to rain on anybody's parade, but when you have the Ring of Steel, the security scare, the anti-gay propaganda that really was just a despicable thing that Putin did right before the Olympics, sort of, when you one hand, it does seem to be very little coherency in the policy. On one hand, you want to show this very friendly and wonderful and soft side of Russia. On the other hand, you're just basically saying, the minute you step left, step right, we're going to shoot you. So that is a bit... that parade in itself becomes less of a parade and more of a military show, even if it's not done in a vein of a military show. So there's always this luring idea that we're watching you. You have to enjoy. It's a very 1984. You have to enjoy yourself, otherwise there's going to be an issue.
Well, it obviously had an effect, the specter of a terrorist threat, because apparently they've given away, 300,000 tickets. And you've got 50,000 military and police there protecting 6,000 athletes. So already with the it seems that there's more police than there are, certainly more police than there are athletes, but in many ways within spectators, right, if they have to give away so many tickets.
Right, and that's my point, is that when you have a celebration like that, you sort of assume that you're safe enough and you're going to enjoy it, but instead you are there under tight security. I mean, there is a reason why Olympics do not go to North Korea, precisely because you kind of have to have a system which doesn't have to protect you that heavily, but you can protect yourself and you can enjoy yourself. So that was basically a wasted Olympics to a degree. I mean, it's a great, I'm happy for the athletes, but was it really worth all the spendings and all the money and all the scare? And now a lot of people who wanted to attend couldn't attend it. So it's, you know, basically a very wrong venue that the Olympic Committee should never have given to this country. That I think would be a good lesson for them in the future to give credit venues to the countries that don't have legal system or enough infrastructure to really make it well, as the Olympics require.
Well, just in the last minute then, Nina Khrushcheva, I mean, there was an odd message there when you had people like Maria Sharapova, the tennis star, because she lives in Florida, she doesn't live in Russia, and a lot of what they're celebrating are overseas Russians, but there seems to be a big difference between, the Russian liberals and the vast narod, as it's called, the supporters of Putin. At the end of the day, we know that the intellectuals don't like, and the educated people, particularly in the cities, don't like Putin. But is there any sense that his popularity is eroding amongst his base?
His popularity is eroding amongst his base because it has become too repetitive, too predictable. And it is really, even for those who want to like him, it's very difficult to ignore that. You know, one hand doesn't know what the the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. So there's a message there, but really, people, you can't not see that it's quickly becoming as fake as the Soviet grand communism was, sort of the later Brezhnev, Leonid Brezhnev years, were very similar in a sense. There was a lot of message, but not a lot of action. So his popularity is eroding, and then, you know, I checked a couple of weeks back. I think it's almost less than 50%. For Russia, it's impossible. It's unbelievable, because we do love our power. So the person in the Kremlin is just by the mere position of his is going to be over 50, and here he is, I think, at 48, which is really not very good news for Putin, I believe.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who is a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back with further analysis of Russia's big event that's on at the moment, the Sochi Olympics, and the fact that the people from the East showed up, but not necessarily from the West.